Please hear the word of the Lord from Romans chapter 8, beginning with verse 28. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to His purpose. For those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, in order that He might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom He predestined, He also called. And those whom He called, He also justified. And those whom He justified, He also glorified. This ends the reading of one of the great. All of them are great. You hate to extend them, but clearly some are better than others. Let's just be honest. One of the great passages in all of the Bible. I don't know if you saw it on the news this week, but I'm not making this up. The Committee on Tall Buildings has met, and they have given the ruling that when it is complete, One World Trade Center will be the tallest building in the United States. It's pretty funny that it's such a big deal whether it's the tallest building or not, and it's even funnier that the name of the committee is the Committee on Tall Buildings. I think the next committee to me was the Committee on Silly Walks, but I'm not sure. What I find fascinating about it, I've really kind of followed it from afar, obviously, but what I find fascinating about this is they have taken this site of one of the great tragedies in our country's history, and they've turned it into something beautiful. And I don't know if you have that gift. I don't. It's very hard for me to even think about New York, the skyline of New York, without in my mind seeing the skyline of those two twin towers standing. And when I see it today, all I can think about is what used to be there. That's all I can see. I see the site of a tragedy. I see a black mark. I see an empty spot. But somebody, a whole committee, a team of people, obviously, was able to see what could be. And they have turned the spot, this place of great tragedy, of terrible death, of senseless death, of destruction, they've turned that into a place that is now filled with something that is beautiful, and that points toward the heavens, and that in many ways is a tribute to the people who died there. That's what this text is talking about. But it's not talking about buildings, of course. It's talking about people. And it's showing us that, well, what the Bible teaches is that you were created to be beautiful. You were beautiful. You were created in the image of God, which means that whenever anyone saw you, they would see some facet of this magnificent, inscrutable God. You would be turning their eyes toward heaven. You would be revealing something to anyone who saw you of how magnificent, how wonderful God is. That's why you were created. That's what you were created to have. But you lost that beauty. We lost our innate beauty in sin. It turned us inward. And you know that about beauty. I mean, the true beauty, I'm not talking about it even on a fleshly level. There's a vast difference between a pretty person, an attractive person, and a beautiful person. A pretty person walks around with absolute just obsession, self-obsession of people are looking at me and I want to look just right. And if you touch me, I'm probably going to lose it. A beautiful person goes around the earth seemingly unaware of their appearance at all. And that's how you were created. You were created to be beautiful. A free, self-forgetful beauty. And we lost that. Our sin made us self-obsessed so that we can't stop thinking about ourselves. Even right now, you're thinking, do I think about myself? See? You are. And God has looked into that destruction, and instead of seeing what was supposed to be there, instead of seeing what used to be there, He is creating something beautiful. He is making you glorious. And as a matter of fact, He has already made you glorious, so that when he sees you, he sees glory. He sees the image of his Son. And the message of this text is really overwhelming if you can receive it. And the message is, you are what God sees in you. You already are what God sees in you. You're not a failure. You're not destroyed. You're not what used to be beautiful. You're not what was supposed to be beautiful. You already are what God sees in you. That's hard for us Presbyterians. I mean, we raise kids to be, you know, cynical. That's our goal. You know, a friend of mine sent me a cartoon of Calvinist bedtime stories. And it was, you know, a little parent reading Curious George. And he says, Curious George was a sinful little monkey and very depraved. You know, that's kind of our mentality. And we really do. We teach it to our children. A professor and a friend of mine named Richard Pratt was preaching at a church. And he saw this girl in her beautiful pink dress. And she went up to her. He went up to her and he said, "Aren't you just an angel?" And she said, "No, sir, I'm a sinner." And he looked at his parents and he said, "You have taught her a half-truth. And because it's a half-truth, it's fully untrue. It's a lie. She is glorious. She is in Christ and she is glorious. And she needs to know that too." And that's true for you. You are glorious. Where do I see that in the text? Look at verse 30. What does it say? It says, "Those whom he predestined, he also called. Those whom he called, he also justified. Those whom he justified, he also glorified." What tense is that in? It's past tense. The ED gives it away. He already glorified. Now, to be called, we get that. He calls us out of our sin. We respond to that. Justified means he's taken the penalty of our sin away, and he's given us his righteousness. We get that. We get that when we believe, we think. But he says he's already glorified us. Now, to me, glorified means your sin has been taken away completely. The presence of sin has been taken away. You're already beautiful. You're already complete. You are already amazing. You contain the glory of God. When do we get that? When will we be separated from the presence and the pollution of sin? When will we be separated from that? When we're resurrected, right? Clearly not. Paul says it's already happened. Now, there's a couple of things going on here. On one level, he's saying, it's what scholars will call the prophetic past tense. It means it's so sure to have happened that we can already speak of it as if it has happened. But I think it's a little bit more than that. A friend of mine took over this church in St. Louis, and when he got there, the deacons were acting like ushers, the elders were acting like deacons, and there was this committee called the leadership committee that was running the church. And he just stepped in, and within 2 weeks of being the pastor of the church, he abolished the leadership committee because there was no reason for it to exist. And one of the women who was on the committee met him in the hallway and says, "I don't think you can do that." And his response was, "Oh, I think I can. I think I did. I think it's done." And that's God looking at you, and all of our fear and all of our trembling, we say, "Make us beautiful? Make us glorious? I don't think you can do that." And he says, "Oh, I think I can. I think I have. I think it's done. It's done. You are. You are what God sees in you." You can think of it in other terms. You can think of it, if the architect theme doesn't get you, you can think of it in the eyes of love. It's not schmaltz. It's true. When you look at somebody you love, you see something different than they see. I can't really quote it to you because the song is just a little more scandalous than I want it to be. It was so scandalous they couldn't play it on the radio back in the 70s. But there's a Conway Twitty song about that, about how this guy is so enamored with his wife. And he says, there's just little things you do that turn me on, like when you stand in the kitchen in your faded cotton gown and your hair all up in rollers. I just love that. It's so magnetic to me. And the funny thing is, if you've ever been in love, you know he's not making that up. It really is beautiful. You really are. Because God is so in love with you, you really are beautiful. You really are glorious. Let's look at this specifically. You are what God sees in you. The first thing I want you to see is that he loved you at first sight. He loved you at first sight. Look at verse 29 here. Those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. Now, let's talk, first of all, you know, the word predestination is in this, and it freaks everybody out. And so the first thing that most of us want to do is say, well, that does not mean what it seems to mean. And so we look at the word foreknew, and we says what that means is God looked into the future, and he saw everybody that was going to choose him, and he chose them first. In the first place, that's just silly. Can we just be honest here? We're in the confines of this room. That definition of foreknowledge and predestination makes no sense. That would be like David pulling into McDonald's today for lunch, and I see that he's done that, and I call him, and I say, I predestined you to go to McDonald's. He's like, I'm in McDonald's. I was already decided to go to McDonald's because I predestined it. No, I went. How could you have predestined me? Well, I didn't stop it. See, I knew that you were going, and I didn't stop it, so I predestined it. How could you have stopped? I could have pulled out a gun and shot you. And that just doesn't, you understand, that reduces this text to nonsense. To say, well, he knew what was going to happen and so he predestined it, just makes the word empty. The second thing it does, when we, and I want you to give a few minutes just to allow this truth, just allow it the possibility of being true. If you've never really made peace with the doctrine of predestination, I'm not going to convince you in the next 30 seconds. But just suspend judgment for a second and think about this. If we refuse to believe that God is the one acting and we are the subject, if we believe that all he does is kind of make things possible for us and respond to us, we've essentially made him our waiter. We've made him dependent upon our orders before he can do anything. And that confuses the whole relationship. You see, point one of your theological education is this: there is a God. Point two is, you're not him. Pretty much all other problems can be referred back to point two. And we don't like that. And so I know people even right now who are saying, you know, they're mad at God. They're not at peace with God because I asked him to do X. I asked him to do Y, and he didn't do it. And my response is, well, you see, if he had have done that for you, then you would go through life confused, thinking that you were the order giver in this relationship. You're not the order giver. You know, you have to have that conversation with your kids when you're raising them. At some point, you know, when they're little, you know, infants, you kind of let them order you around. They cry and you respond. But at some point, that gets old. And at some point, it's going to confuse them as they grow up. And somewhere along the way, you have to let them know that you're the parent and they will do what you tell them to do. Because for their own good, yes. Because you know better, yes. But they don't get all that yet. Right now, they just need to get the fact that you're the parent and they will do what you tell them to do. God starts you out on the right step here. First thing you need to know is, I'm the Lord. I predestined you. That's why you're in this relationship. I knew you before you knew me. That's why you're in this relationship. You didn't all of a sudden say, hey, I want to be near you. No one seeks after God. I knew you. I'm the one who started it. So you've got to get that here and now. And worship me and receive that. So evacuating this doctrine, this word, from what it actually means has great consequence. We also miss out on what it does mean. He loves us. You see what it means? Those whom he foreknew, he predestined. He foreknew. Now, again, we got to remember, this is not just knowledge like, I know you exist. What does the Bible mean when it says knowledge, someone knew someone? Usually it's followed by a baby being born. Adam knew Eve and she conceived. Abraham knew Sarah and she conceived. It's an intimate word. When David talks about God's knowledge of him, he says, you have known me. You know my coming and my going. You know my thoughts before they're on my tongue. You know where I will end up. You know my paths before I walk them. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. I cannot conceive it. You know me. And what this text is saying is God knew you. And he set his love on you. And he has destined you for beauty and for glory. Before you've done anything to accept it. Before you've done anything to earn it. As a matter of fact, when you were doing everything to not earn it. I mean, think about what that means for him. It's not like love at first sight. I'm going to fall in love with you and be happy and better than I ever was before. It's love at first sight that means I see you. I see that loving you is going to mean that I have to die on a cross. I see that loving you means I'm going to have to bleed and suffer and be betrayed. I see that loving you means that I'm going to scream out into the darkness, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I think you're worth it. That's what this text said. Those whom he foreknew, he predestined. Knowing what it was going to cost. Loving you at first sight. Loving you intimately. And once he sets his love upon his bride, he begins wooing her to himself. He wins her affection. Verse 30 says, those whom he predestined, he also called. And there's two kinds of calls in the Bible. There's a universal call. Jesus stands up and says, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. When God calls out in Isaiah, turn to me, all you ends of the earth, and be saved. When Jesus says, no one will come to me and be cast out. That's the universal call. And if you don't respond to that universal call, you have no one to blame but yourself. God is not giving you the Heisman. He is not telling you, you're not good enough for me. I don't want you. He is calling all people to himself. He says in Isaiah, and he quotes it again in Romans 9, all day long I've extended my arms to a stubborn and insubordinate people. And one of the last things that Jesus said on his way to the cross, he began weeping over Jerusalem, and he said, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I longed to gather you under my arms. His call is universal, but that's not the specific call that's being talked about in this text. In this text, he's talking about a call that is a particular effective call that empowers the response. It's like when God walked out on the day of creation and he stood where there was no place to stand because there was nothing to stand on. And he looked out upon darkness because there was no light. And he didn't say, I want to make a sun that will give off light. He just said, light. And light appeared. He didn't create the sun till later, which messes some of you up. Like, how can he do that? Well, but he can because he's God. Go back to point one and point two of your theology. The sun is not God. God's not dependent upon the sun for light. His voice is enough to create light. And when he calls you his voice makes it happen. He is working behind the scenes, opening your eyes so that you see your sin and your guilt, opening your eyes so that you see the beauties of Christ, opening your eyes so you see that it's preferable to be with Jesus than it is to be independent and separate from him. And he enables you to respond unto his call. He's working behind the scenes, see? I have a friend who told me, I don't know how we got started on this, but we were talking about how our parents met. And he said, oh, well, mine is a pretty funny story. You see, my mom was in college and her boyfriend was at a far away college. And it was before phones, really, and back when... not before phones, but back when long distance was extremely expensive. I actually remember those days. You know, I remember when, like, long distance calls were expensive, like 10 cents a minute. You couldn't do that. And so they just wrote letters. Well, her boyfriend never wrote her back. And she found this guy on campus who was always so kind to her. And he always seemed to know when she was going to be feeling low. And he was always just there for her. And she ended up breaking up with her boyfriend and marrying him. Obviously, this guy ended up being my dad. And they've been married for 30 years now. What she didn't know was that this guy who was always there for her worked in the mailroom. And whenever those letters from her boyfriend arrived in the mailroom, they made it into the trash can before they made it into her mailbox. See, he was working. See, from her perspective, she was falling in love with someone who was disinterested, who didn't even know that she existed. But in reality, he already loved her, and he wanted her so bad he was really willing to break federal laws to get her. And that's kind of what's going on with us. Obviously, God's not breaking federal laws, and I wouldn't care if he did. But mark that and remove it from the tape. We think that all of a sudden one day we just think to ourselves, oh, I should follow Christ. We think that that was our decision. We have no idea that God has been working for centuries to get you to a place where you would hear the gospel. He's been working behind the scenes for centuries to get you to a place where you would see your sin and see how destructive it is, and that you would want to respond to him. We have no idea what God's been doing behind the scenes. And when we find that out much later, we get kind of mad about it. I thought that was my decision. You say, how dare you say that I was predestined to this? Well, you just have no idea. God is at work. He loves you too much to let you go. And he's working behind the scenes to woo you to himself, to bring you to himself. And some of us want to say, get paralyzed by this doctrine. Well, how do I know if I've been called? How do I know if I've been predestined? Well, this text tells us that if you've been predestined, you'll respond to this call. Those whom he predestined, he called. Well, how do I know if I've been called? Well, do you want to come to Jesus? Then come. You've been called. Everybody's been called, actually. You know that you're predestined if you respond to the call. If you don't respond, well, evidently not. But don't worry about that. God's not going to get you up to this Lord's table and go, no, and throw you away. If you want to come, you're called. That's the reason why you want to come, is because you're called. If you're worried about it, you're called. People who, again, only Christians have worry about assurance of salvation. There's thousands and thousands of unbelievers in the city, and none of them are sitting around worried about whether they are saved or not. They're not even awake yet. You don't worry about whether or not you're called. If you respond, if you come to Jesus, then you're called. It's the reason why you come. Well, but how can I, if I'm unable to do it without him, then I'm paralyzed. I don't know what to do. I should just wait. I mean, what can I do? If there's nothing I can do, then there's nothing I can do, right? You're telling me there's nothing I can do to respond to God. Actually, I'm not saying that. There's nothing I can do to make God like me, so I'm just paralyzed by that, right? No, I'm not. Obviously, you're not paralyzed by it. Have you ever been too tired to fall down? Have you ever been too exhausted to stop standing? That's what responding to God looks like. It looks like falling down upon him, trusting him to receive you. Preaching your inability is the best thing you can ever hear. No, there's nothing you can do to make God like you anymore. There's nothing you can do to make him seek after you. He's already sought after you. Just respond. Just stop trying to make yourself better and receive what he has given you. Just receive it. Those whom he's predestined, he's also called. Those whom he called, he's also justified. He has removed all of the obstacles that stood between him and us. We could not be with him because we were under the penalty of sin. We were guilty of sin and we deserved his righteous wrath. So he sent his son to pay that penalty for us. We could not be with him because being with him requires obedience and goodness and following after him and loving our neighbor and not loving ourselves and worshiping him and putting him before ourselves. And we couldn't do that. We have not done that. We have not earned that. And so he sent his son to do it for us. It's like back decades and decades ago, children, when there was these little things called checkbooks. And back before, there was this thing called the interweb and all its magnificence. And we had no idea how much money was actually in the bank. And all he had to go on was this letter we would get once a month that would show us all the things that had shown up in our bank account. And we had to go through our little register and check them off and go, oh, I forgot about that check. And we did something called justifying our bank book, taking that balance, subtracting all of our checks, adding in all of our deposits, finding out if it was short. It always was short. And then adding in what needs to be there. God comes into us and he says, your bank book is terribly unjustified. And not only are you short, you have penalties and penalties and penalties built up. And he pays the penalties for us. And he pays off the debts. And he removes all the obstacles so that his bride can be with him and so that we can be what he sees us to be. He gives us his good name so that we can come into his fellowship. He woos, falls in love with us at first sight. He woos us to himself. He purchases his bride. And finally, his marriage day is complete. Those whom he justified, he also glorified. This picture of glorification is a picture of our wedding day when we appear in bright white garments and he looks upon us perfect and beautiful. I love doing weddings. I get to do those. When I was a campus minister, I did a ton. I would do 4, 5, 6 a summer. And they were all fun. Every wedding is special. Everyone, but some were better than others. Some were more special than others. And it really kind of depended upon what the church was like. I did this one in a church where it was a little bit like this. There wasn't a central door in the middle. There were the doors on the outside, but it was a real steep angle to the floor. And we were standing on the floor so that when, you know, the great moment came and the bride appeared in the back and everybody turns to see it, the groom could not see her. Everybody's standing. They're all, you know, the floor's going up. You can see the door open. You can see the light coming through the door. You get a sense there's probably somebody standing back there. Everybody starts going, oh, and he couldn't see her. And it was driving him crazy to the point that he started like, where is she? Where is she? And he kind of looked at me with this panicked look. And he just took off up the aisle so that he could see her. I'm not about to tell you that you should feel that way about Jesus. Aren't you sorry that you're not so excited to see Jesus? I want you to understand that Jesus is that excited about seeing you. You are his bride. In your glory, the righteous deeds of the saints, the white garments. That's the reason why brides wear white at weddings. Because the bride in Revelation 21 wears white at the wedding. And he is excited to see you. He's already seen you. You are that glorious person. It's already there. He's removing a little bit of the sin that gets in the way. He's removing a little bit of the dirt. But he's already seen it. You're already there. And I want you to believe, Paul wants you to believe, Jesus wants you to believe that you already are what God sees in you. Please pray with me. Father, we do long for that day when we will wake up and we'll see you in heaven, not more secure than we are today, not more loved than we are today, not more forgiven than we are today, not more beautiful than we are today, but Father, happier, more aware of your goodness, stronger in our faith, able to see you, able to see Jesus and never doubt him again, able to see him and believe that whatever he has called us to go through was worth it, because he can surely be trusted. Father, I pray that you would even right now be sending out your Holy Spirit to enable us to respond to your call.